Good evening, everyone, and what a wonderful turnout as usual. Thank you so much for being here. And it is with the greatest pleasure that I welcome you to this third lecture of Leon Panetta 2017 lecture series. And this, of course, is as we continue our discussion of the Trump presidency and its impact on the future of the United States of America. Before we turn to the subject of tonight's forum and our distinguished guests on this Memorial Day, I would like to begin by honoring the brave men and women in uniform who sacrifice and have sacrificed so much in protecting our country and our democracy. You know, even as we express our concern and pose questions about current events, this discussion is always done knowing that we are truly blessed to live in this great nation. And I know you'll agree. We salute all who have fought and will continue to fight on her behalf. This evening, we'll discuss parties, politics, and governing. When then-candidate Trump accepted the Republican nomination for president, he warned that the nation was in crisis, and he promised to fix it. But he became president in a Washington that was dysfunctional, partisan, divided, and unable to govern. Washington continues to be mired in gridlock, and the American people are still awaiting action on a host of issues, including health care, including the budget, including tax reform, including immigration, and including infrastructure funding. Perhaps even more concerning is the extreme divisiveness that came to characterize the election. And this still deeply divides the American people. The nation is split among economic, ideological, and racial lines. Serious questions have emerged regarding Russian interference in the campaign and the level of involvement of the Trump campaign. The Trump administration has questioned the impartiality and role of the press. And there are growing concerns about leaks coming from the White House. Can our democracy function in the middle of all this turmoil? Can Americans still have confidence in the basic institutions of our democracy, such as the press and free and fair elections? How have politics and the parties responded to the crises in our democracy and in our ability to govern? Where are the possibilities for healing and for compromise? Is the electorate itself prepared to accept its responsibility for the current state of affairs? Tonight, we'll ask these questions of three experts who have seen our system in action from inside the White House, from presidential campaigns, from party politics, and from journalism. Our first guest has served as a trusted advisor to four presidents and to both political parties. A United States Navy veteran, his political career began when he joined the Nixon administration, first as an assistant speechwriter and later as chief speechwriter. He served in the Ford administration as director of communications and was later a member of the Reagan administration's communication team, where he was eventually named assistant to the president for communications. In 1993, he agreed to serve as a counselor to President Clinton on both domestic and foreign affairs, eventually becoming a special international advisor to the president and to Secretary of State Warren Christopher. He wrote about those experiences in his bestseller, Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, Nixon to Clinton. In the 80s, he began his career in journalism. Starting with the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour, he has been a regular commentator on public affairs for more than 30 years. He has twice been a member of election coverage teams that won Peabody Awards and has contributed to two Emmy Award-winning political analysis teams. Today, he's a professor and co-director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and a senior political analyst for CNN. He has a BA from Yale University and a JD from Harvard Law School. Please welcome David Gergen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Our second guest has more than 30 years' experience in politics and has worked on every presidential campaign from 1976 to 2000. She worked for Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign in 1984, Dick Gephardt's presidential primary run, and Michael Dukakis' general election campaign. In 1999, she was named campaign manager for the Gore-Lieberman presidential campaign, becoming the first African-American to manage a presidential campaign. She is the former vice chair for civic engagement and voter participation at the Democratic National Committee and the former chair of the DNC's Voting Rights Institute. In 2016, she assumed the role of interim chair of the Democratic National Committee. The author of the best-selling memoir, Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, she has appeared on CNN's Inside Politics, Crossfire, and is a regular contributor for ABC's This Week. Among several other honors, she received the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's highest award for political achievement and was named the 2016 Wonk of the Year by the Kennedy Political Union at American University. She earned her undergraduate degree from Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. Please welcome Donna Brazil. Welcome.
Thank you.
Our third guest serves as political analyst for ABC News and editor of the influential Washington-based political magazine, The Weekly Standard. He is widely recognized as one of the nation's leading political analysts and one of the most influential conservatives in Washington. He came to Washington in 1985 to join the Reagan administration, first as chief of staff to Education Secretary William J. Bennett, and then as Chief of Staff to Vice President Dan Quayle. A savvy political strategist, he chaired the Project for the Republican Future, where he helped shape the 1994 Republican congressional victory. He is a regular on ABC's This Week and on the network's special events and election coverage, and he has also appeared frequently on other leading political commentary programs, including CNN Crossfire, MSNBC Morning Joe, and Fox Special Report. A powerful voice on America's role in the world, he was the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The War Over Iraq, Saddam's Tyranny and America's Mission. He received his AB and PhD from Harvard University. Please welcome William Kristol.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Finally, leading this discussion is a man who's been in and out of Washington for more than 50 years. He's seen what our democracy can accomplish and has observed Washington at its best and at its worst. Please welcome Panetta Institute Chairman and our distinguished moderator, Leon E. Panetta. I love you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the third forum of the Panetta Lecture Series. Our theme, which is pretty relevant these days, the Trump presidency and the future of America. And we've talked about healthcare in the first forum. We talked about the economy. Tonight we talk about our democracy, politics, parties, and whether or not they can govern. I don't think there's any question that today our democracy is being tested, and the institutions of our democracy are being tested. Tested by a divided Washington that finds it difficult to govern, tested by an unpredictable president, tested now by a special counsel and investigating committees on the Hill looking at Russian interference in our political process, tested by a very dangerous world in which there are a number of flashpoints that could produce a serious crisis, and the American people, as a result of all of that, are anxious and nervous about what does the future hold. Our country has gone through a number of crises throughout our history, and somehow we've always survived. Survived because of the men and women in uniform that have been willing to fight and die for our country that we honor today on Memorial Day. Survived because we have strong institutions in our democracy, strong system of checks and balances that our forefathers gave us. And we have survived because the American people are willing to exercise freedom of speech in order to talk about the problems that confront this country. And that's what we do tonight with our three speakers, all of whom have had great experience in our democracy. And we are pleased and honored to have them. Let me begin by an obvious question, which is the question about where we are now after 4 months of the Trump presidency. It's been a hell of a ride. David Axelrod, I think, compared it to being on a 747 with a six-year-old at the pilot seat, bumping along in turbulence and not quite sure whether you're going to land or whether a co-pilot is going to take charge. At the same time, this president continues to enjoy strong support from Republicans and from the base of support that supported him in the election because they like the way he shakes things up in Washington. So, first question, what is your view of the Trump presidency and where are we headed? Is this plane going to land or should we fasten our seat belts? David.
Keep your seatbelt fastened. Listen, first of all, it's a privilege to join this panel, to be here for the Panetta Institute, to come on Memorial Day and find a place in the country that sent a veteran to Congress, and namely this Jimmy Panetta, who's representing this area so well now. And if you haven't already, may I recommend that you find the NPR piece that played this morning about a new book called The Gatekeepers, and it's about men, so far only men, I'm afraid, but it was about chiefs of staff at the White House, and the author made the very strong point, with which I agree, that the two best chiefs of staff in the history of the White House, one is Jim Baker, a Republican, and the other is Leon Panetta. It does seem we've been in a rather dark passage, but I'm among those, I think Bill Kristol may agree with this, who actually think there's good news out there. And that is, it's very clear after 4 months the Republic will survive, which is important. There was a time before this all began when people worried that Donald Trump would become an authoritarian leader, another strong man of the kind he seems to be so attracted to that he might even become a more dictatorial president. And it's now clear that that's not going to happen. checks and balances are working and working well, including the special counsel's office, which I think is actually a blessing for the country in that we now have an investigation that will be fair, that will be impartial, that will be thorough, and at the end of it, hopefully, it'll bring the country together and not split us apart. It's also true, I think, that we've now learned that Donald Trump is not going to become an authoritarian leader because the people around him are so damn incompetent. You know, they just don't have the capacity to get there, do you think? I have many, many reservations and reasons to be appalled by some of the things we're seeing. But I do think that there are areas where I hope the president still can make progress. If he can make progress on the creation of more jobs, we should support him on that. We should thank him for that. If he can make progress in fixing the healthcare system so it's more compassionate, we should support him on that. I think the infrastructure ideas, there's much there that can be done. So there's much you can be done in the welfare of the people. I think the track he is now on is not leading in that direction. And for that, I think that, you know, you have to stand up and say. And I think it's been difficult for us and those of us who are in the media or trying to be fair. You know, sometimes it's hard to find things that, okay, this is not working, this is terrible, this is appalling. Now, what can I say that's good? And you look over there and you sort of, what can I say that's, you know, that, and looking around, and it's, and you therefore I think that, yeah, exactly. So I do think that one of the things that we in the media have to do is avoid a chase. Our role is not to bring down Donald Trump. Our role is to try to understand, to explain, to make sure you, the public, have the facts. You're the citizens here that we're serving. And our job is to be, I think, to be as fair as possible. And there are times, I think, we get a little too over-eager in the chase.
Donna?
I'll leave it there.
Thank you, David. Thank you. And I totally agree with David that our job is not to bring down Donald Trump. Donald Trump is doing a fine job of bringing himself. Whoever that might be. First of all, what a great honor it is to be back in this beloved state of California. I love you all. There are 55 different reasons why I love you. But most importantly, I love this beautiful land. And I must say, I enjoy being here because I have found the best wine as well. To all our veterans here and to those who have served, I'm forever grateful for your service and your sacrifice. And so it's a great honor to be here with Leon Panetta and Sylvia Panetta. I first met the congressman. He was then a congressman back in the days when I was on Capitol Hill working for Dick Gephardt and Eleanor Holmes Norton, among others, and of course, during the Clinton-Gore administration. He is not just a great public servant, but he is a voice of reason, and I just so much appreciate your public service. The Trump presidency, I've watched the Trump presidency from two vantage points. One, I watched it as a partisan throughout the election as the chair of the party and someone who had to set up the war room to inform the American people about some of his policies and, of course, some of his nominees to various cabinet positions. I have watched him now as a citizen, and now that I have decided to go fishing for a while, to figure out my next step in American politics. And while I have every bit of respect for the president, the presidency itself, I'm worried. I'm worried that this is a president without a compass, a moral compass, a political compass, because I don't think he's really a conservative. I think he's pretending to be a Republican, but who knows what Donald Trump truly is. I read his tweets practically every day. I study them to figure out exactly why he's tweeting and what he's tweeting about. And still, I regard the White House as being befuddled. In order to make progress in this country, you have to build alliances, you have to build coalitions, and you have to learn how to work across the aisle. And what I've seen so far from Donald Trump is it's his way or the highway. And so while I don't have that much respect for the way in which he has governed us for, I hope that this White House, this president, continue to keep us safe and secure, And I am going to figure out a way as an American to protect and preserve our democracy, because I do believe that we deserve better. So I don't know how many of you are counting down the days, 1,331 until the official end of his term. But until that day, I'm going to continue to keep the president, his family, and of course his administration in my thoughts and prayers, because that's where we are. Over, as you all know, 133 million Americans voted, 90 million Americans stayed home. And as a result of that, we're in a period of what I call a disruption until we the people decide to become more informed and more engaged in our government, and we should begin to do that now. We need more citizens to be engaged. Thank you for having me.
David and Donna are so concerned to be fair and balanced. I myself am not particularly inclined to be fair to Donald Trump, since I think he hijacked a Republican Party that I was rather fond of, and I think he'd done a lot of good for the country, and runs the risk, and this is why I'm probably a little more hostile to him maybe than even David and Donna, runs the risk of really turning the Republican Party into a party that I don't think will be a healthy party for America, a nationalist and somewhat xenophobic, America First, as he himself calls it, party, as opposed to the kind of Reaganite internationalist party, conservative, limited government, but not, Reagan's Republican Party really is night and day, I think, compared to Trump's. And so I personally would like very much, I think it's important for the future of the country, actually, to have a Reaganite Republican Party and a Reaganite conservative movement. So one reason I probably a little less willing to give Trump a break, or even David at least goes to the trouble of looking for things to praise in the Trump administration, whereas I just kind of ignore that. But having said that, first of all, it's great to be here, obviously, with Leon and Sylvia and David and Donna, and great to be on Memorial Day. As David and I drove out from Monterey, we saw a very nice Memorial Day ceremony at the Monterey City Hall, and it did make me feel, you know, this is happening throughout America. It's a sound country. The citizenry, I think, are basically sound. The institutions are strong. I think we've seen that so far in the Trump presidency, both governmental institutions and private institutions and non-governmental institutions, civic institutions. So I feel pretty optimistic about the future of the country. I guess the topic of our panel is the Trump presidency and the future of America. I'm optimistic about the future of America, pretty pessimistic about the Trump presidency, to be honest. And look, I mean, putting on my political science hat for just a minute, since I once taught it, just empirically, I think it's hard to see that he's on a very good path. I mean, he was elected with 46% of the vote. His approval rating is now about 39 or 40%. Bill Clinton actually managed to get down to around there around this time, interestingly. The only other president, that was before Leon was chief of staff, of course. And I don't say that jokingly. I mean, Leon came in and helped right a somewhat rocky ship there after a year and a half, 2 years of the Clinton presidency. But Bill Clinton learned, I mean, he was not maybe quite ready, I think it's fair to say, and some of his people, to take over the presidency after being governor of a pretty small state, but he learned pretty fast. And one of the things that most worries me about Trump, just, you know, really being honest here, is I wasn't for him, I didn't like him, I didn't vote for him, but I did think that when he became president-elect, and then when he became president, he would be struck by the gravity of his task, the importance of the office, and change his ways some. I wasn't being unrealistic. He's 70 years old, no one changes that much, but I thought, you know, people can still adjust. And I would say that what most worries me is that he doesn't seem to have adjusted to really the what it means to be president of the United States, the seriousness of that, the need to consider what you say, the fact that you can say something that parts of your base might like when you're traveling abroad, you can stick it to the Europeans and tell them to pay up and not think one or two steps ahead, and not worry about what the German reaction is going to be and what German politics will then reward the German who stands up to Trump. And then suddenly an alliance that was carefully constructed and maintained for 70 years gets awfully rickety, and that could happen elsewhere around the world. So I'm worried about the Trump presidency. I don't think we're going to lose our civil liberties at home. I think the country is in good shape. The institutions are in good shape. The world is a very dangerous place, as Leon knows better than anyone else in this room. And there the president is less checked. I'm very heartened by his foreign policy team, where I think we got kind of lucky, honestly. I think in the first 100 days of the Trump presidency, the single best thing that happened, honest, and it sounds snarky when I say it, which is okay, but I mean it seriously, was the replacement of Trump's initial choice as National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, by H.R. McMaster. I think if the Trump presidency ends up non-disastrous, which is possible, I think historians will look back and say McMaster becoming National Security Advisor was a huge moment. It doesn't say something very good about Trump, honestly, President Trump, that he was willing to pick Michael Flynn, I think, as his National Security Advisor, knowing what he knew at the time, knowing what we know now. We're lucky that we've got McMaster there, we've got James Mattis at Defense, other serious people in some key positions. So that gives me some heart and some hope. And you know, this is a strong country, and we'll make it through. But I just wish, it's not just the tweets, and sometimes this is, you know, Mitch McConnell says, oh, I just wish he weren't creating that much drama. That's not the point. I mean, you can have presidents who are undisciplined and say a few foolish things, but the degree to which he's risking serious achievements, both at home in this country over the last 3, 4, 5 decades, and abroad, I think, by a kind of reckless failure to be responsible, worries me.
Let me ask you, there's been a number of rapid-fire events, obviously, that I'd like to get your reaction to, and so that we can finish sometime this year. I'd like you to be as brief as possible in your comments. Let's start with this 9-day foreign trip. It was a pretty intense trip through Saudi Arabia, Jerusalem, the Vatican, NATO, G7, a lot of mixed reviews. Tell me how you would grade the trip from a foreign policy point of view and from an American leadership point of view. David?
He gets an A for a well-scripted, well-planned trip, contrary to a lot of the helter-skelter way this White House has conducted business. I think he gets a B minus and it's problematic what he's trying to do with the Saudis. And other Gulf and the Sunni alliance that he's trying to put together. You know, Barack Obama made a bet that if you could hold back Iran for 15 years or so in building nukes, that a new generation would come to power and they would be much more pro-Western, pro-development. I think that was actually a good bet. And Trump has come in and thrown that bet out the window and basically says, I'm not counting on the Iranians. We're going to just put a lot of sanctions. And I think that's problematic, even though I like the fact he's a more reliable friend right now for the Gulf nations. Where I think, and Bill and I think are both on the same page on this, I really think where the president got a terribly failing grade was in his trip to Western Europe. To go in and bully our greatest friends in the world, to have them as alarmed as they are, you know, Chancellor Merkel has now made it very clear in the last 24 hours that she now thinks that Europe must find its own way, that it must be determined its own fate, that it can no longer rely upon the United States for leadership, and her opposition leader has come out staunchly on her side and said that Trump was humiliating to the leader of their country, and that's totally unacceptable. I think to kick our closest friends in the chins, as we've been doing, and this is not the first time, I think is a terrible way to run foreign policy.
The okay. White House told the White House told first. Of all. I think to go overseas and to tell our European allies that we cannot discuss two major issues that concern them, the refugee crisis, the migration issue, and Syria, and then come away by tweeting that you made a home run simply because you didn't have any gaffes from reading the teleprompter. I give him a C-. The shove of the newest member of NATO from Montenegro, this handshake thing, I don't get this man thing. Is this a man thing? I mean, why don't you just give somebody the dab? Just yeah. Thank you. Right. That's different. But this whole man thing, there were times when he looked presidential, but I just simply believe a president that cannot go overseas and hold briefings with reporters, American reporters, and one that lectures our allies and then bullies them is not a president who deserved high marks from his first overseas trip.
Bill?
Yeah. I agree with what's been said, and I come back to this foreign policy. There more depends on the president himself, on his character, on his judgment, obviously, in a crisis. We haven't really seen a serious crisis, which is good so far, but one obviously worries about that. But yeah, I mean, people tend to take for granted after 70 years the international world order in which we live, which the U.S. is the anchor of, anchor in defense, the anchor in security, the anchor politically, the anchor economically. And it's, of course, nothing needs to be treated as if it's sacred and, you know, can never be challenged. NATO could use some fixing. Trade deals probably could be fixed as well. You know, these are all, there are lots of real debates about our force structure and all these kinds of issues. But I think the place to begin is to say, you know what, the last 70 years in world history have not been as bad as an awful lot of 70-year stretches in world history, like the preceding 70 years, just to take an obvious example, or the preceding first half of the 20th century. Maybe we learned lessons from that. Maybe we overlearned some of them. We were a little simple-minded in some of them. Still, they were basically correct. They were basically correct. You know, hundreds of millions, billions of people have gone from abject poverty in East Asia to decent lives over the last 30, 40 years. That's because of an international system, both in terms of security and in terms of, incidentally, trade and free flows of capital that has helped those people come out of poverty. And the U.S. has benefited greatly. We fought World War I. Think about this. Between what, 1917 and 1972, we fought World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And, I mean, that was in, what, a 55-year period or something like that. Since then, we've had plenty of challenges. We've had wars that haven't turned out as well as we hoped, and other challenges abroad, and the rise of Islamist extremism and terrorism and other things that have to be dealt with. And Putin, it's unfortunate that Russia didn't make it all the way in the way that its neighbors did in some respects to modern liberal democracy. But we live in a world that could be a lot worse. You know, I remember during the campaign, one of the big lines, I would argue with my fellow Republicans who were inclined to be for Trump, and, you know, we need to send someone in there to shake up Washington, to drain the swamp, to kick people, and really, you know, and I'd say, well, isn't it kind of risky? Can't get worse. Can't be worse than it is. It's like, really? I mean, America in 2016, an awful lot of places have been an awful lot worse, both at home and abroad. Now, it sounds like kind of an old fogeyish thing to say, and it's a very conservative thing to say with a little c, but I really think people underestimate the risks we're taking. And I hope President Trump sees the risks you're taking when you set in motion a dynamic where the Europeans, or for that matter, the Asians and Japan, lose faith in us and lose confidence in us. We've taken for granted the fact that there's been no conflict. I mean, the one conflict in Europe in the 90s that was ended by bipartisan support for President Clinton. He got rid of Milosevic. Russia's done some bad things on the borders here, but those have been contained at least, and we have sanctions. In Asia, no real conflict since 1978. That's not the way it's always been in Europe or Asia. And it's very risky, I think, to sort of be very cavalier about that status quo and assume that one can just disrupt alliances, threaten trade deals. Again, whatever the details, whatever the truth of some of the criticisms, you really don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater here. And I do worry about that with Donald Trump.
Okay, he comes back to Washington he starts facing immediately the turmoil around the Russian investigation. The Washington Post reports that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, spoke with the Russian ambassador in December about setting up a secret channel with the Trump transition team directly to Moscow so that they could talk about Syria and other issues. Secret channels have been used in the past, but generally with rogue nations where we don't have formal relations. But here they're trying to set it up with Russia. Why Russia, and who are they trying to avoid keeping in the loop as a result of that? David?
We could be here for breakfast, right?
Seriously?
I think we need to be very careful and not reaching hard conclusions about this yet. You know, let the Trump people come and present their evidence and let some people sort it out on the legal side and then let's take a look at it. But let's not reach a hard conclusion that he ought to be impeached or this or that or the other. You know, I think in fairness to everybody, let's let the investigation do its work and complete. And at the same time, I don't think it's unreasonable as citizens or people in the media to say, there are very suspicious patterns here. Very suspicious patterns. And we can't explain. But I first of all think that the old advice that came out of Watergate from Deep Throat to Bob Woodward was follow the money. Follow the money. And I would argue that what Mueller's investigation is going to be focusing on before it's all over is where did money come and go before the campaign? There are a lot of folks who believe, who have quite serious credentials in New York that I've talked to, worked with them in the past, that there was a period of time in Donald Trump's business life when he was flat on his back, things weren't going well, and he could no longer get money from American banks. And basically, American banks will tell you they wouldn't do business with him because it was a nightmare. They didn't get paid back. You know, there was always got litigious, so forth and so on. And there was a period in his life when he had to turn to foreign money. And one of his sons had said, foreign money, Russian money came pouring in. Russian money came pouring in. Now, we don't know to how much Russian money or Ukrainian money or money that's been laundered came into the Trump organization, but may have made him feel obliged or for whatever reason have a set of relationships with the Russians that then played over into when the Russians started meddling in our elections. That with the meddling is quite clear. But we don't know sort of what connections were then made. Do we have some just three or four people from the netherworld of politics? Leon and I have talked about this. There are people in the dark side of politics on both sides of the aisle who are in it basically for the money and what they can get out of something. And would they go over lines? Yeah, they're rogue kind of guys. And it may well be that there are two or three people who are rogues in his organization who they get nailed and maybe they go to the slammer. We don't know yet, right? But what we don't know is does that then extend up to the president? And the danger from the Kushner investigation is for the first time it brings it right inside the White House. The probe is going inside the White House. And Leon will tell you, this is the fourth time in his lifetime that we've had a special counsel investigating people high up in the White House. And that is dangerous stuff. And I hope for the country's sake this is wrapped up with reasonable speed. But most of all, it's a determination that at the end of the day, everybody can look at it and say, that was thorough, they found the facts, and whatever they find is conclusive, and it's not sort of hazy and then become usually politicized and a source of yet more polarization. I think it's so important that this special counsel have access to everything. And if you find people, you know, refusing to give over papers, refusing to testify, you know, looking for immunity, like Flynn is looking for immunity, that's highly suspicious as well. I think we're into highly suspicious territory. I think we could be in impeachment territory, in one sense that ultimately may be where this goes. But I think the big thing is we have to wait and see how all these suspicions play out.
Donna, you were in the middle of the Russian interference with the election. What do you think?
Placebo. That's thank you in Russia. I mean, to call it highly unusual. I mean, first of all, we had an administration. We had a Secretary of State, John Kerry. We had channels, official channels, to discuss Syria and other issues with Russia. Why was there any need for someone who had, one, not served in government, not received his security clearance, to be trying to find a back channel through and around the Obama administration and through and around the intelligence services? That should raise a lot of suspicion. I don't have all of the answers. I wish I knew all of the answers. What I do know and what I did experience personally firsthand was the Russian interference and meddling in our democracy. It was not a harmless experience. I've worked on 10 presidential campaigns. I have 56 congressional campaigns, 19 state and local campaigns, 49 states, one more state. I'm going to become Miss USA without the bikini. And how many of you have ever started a campaign when you had to get a briefing from the federal officials that says, we need to tell you about what is happening at your party? And then all of a sudden, you are informed about the FSB. Leon Padena might know about the FSB. He might know about the GRU. I mean, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, look, I avoid the National Zoo because I don't want to even see the panda bear. and this notion that we would have someone on the other side almost calling for a hostile foreign government to release emails, to interfere, to use the emails in a weaponized form for propaganda purposes. So yes, I agree with David. We should follow the facts. We should find ways to ensure that this never happens again so that we can strengthen our democracy. The steps I had to take as chair of the party to not just protect our institution, but to protect the individuals involved. They didn't just harass people. They went after people with intimidation tactics. There were times in which I would get up in the morning and hear a report and then come to the office and deal with suspicious packages. Staff people worried that that might be the last day that they would live. I would also deploy staff outside of D.C. because I was worried about their health. So this was not just the interference of of what I call the garden variety. How many of you went to Home Depot and got a notice later that Home Depot was hacked? I'm one of those individuals. I thought when the Chinese hacked into our so-called OPM system, Office of Personnel Management, that was enough for me. Oh, the Chinese hacked you. Mm-hmm. Oh, try the Russians. I've had both. And so I would like our country to get to the bottom of these investigations. I believe we should have a bipartisan commission so that we can prevent this from happening again. In the middle of the election, I wasn't worried as much about the Democratic Party as I started to worry about our country. I went into the DNC as a partisan and I left as a patriot. My dad's spirit came over me as somebody who served in our military, and I just kept thinking our country is under attack. And for the vast majority of the days I was chair, nobody cared. We couldn't even get the press to pay attention to. Everybody thought we were crazy. In fact, I thought I was crazy too, because I couldn't believe that this was happening. And there's nobody to call. You can't go to Home Depot, or you can't go to Best Buy or Staples and buy anti-hacking software. I mean, Donald Trump made it seem like, well, they just need to go and get some software. Hell, it doesn't exist. This is a foreign hostile intelligence service attacking a democratic institution. You may or may not like political parties. You may or may not like the press, but you know what? This is what makes America a strong country. We have these democratic institutions. And when you see a foreign government involvement and no one cares, I'm gratified that we have these investigations. And I'm looking forward to Congress and Mr. Mueller to get to the bottom of it.
How much did you think they cost Hillary in the election? Did they cost her the election? Were they a major factor?
I believe it was a factor because, look, it wasn't the only thing. Okay, Donald Trump cracked the blue wall because we left the lock open. Okay, 78,132 votes. We lost the city of Detroit because we lost it because we won it 511,000, but compared to President Obama who had 592,000, I can't blame everything on the Russians. But I do believe that their meddling, their involvement in taking and weaponizing emails. They didn't weaponize emails that were pro-Clinton. They weaponized emails that they assumed were anti-Sanders. And so while the Republican convention ended on July 15th, our primary didn't end until November 8th when the election was over. It sowed division. And I think because of the weaponization of the emails themselves, Hillary's coverage was 70% negative. These are studies, you can go and see it yourself. Donald Trump had a pretty good primary season. I mean, he received the lion's share of all of the coverage, and it was mostly positive. Hillary had a hell of a time getting her message out. And yes, David, when you hack into an email system, you steal data, you steal and corrupt files. You harass your donors. It does have an impact. I don't think it was the only factor, but it did cause us a lot of problems throughout the campaign.
Bill, let me ask you in responding to this question, if you just comment on why do you think that Director Comey was fired?
I mean, Donald Trump didn't like him, and and as he said, he wanted to do it all along, and then he constructed this sort of phony excuse. I mean, he put the Deputy Attorney General in a terrible position. I mean, it's a good example of him not thinking through at all, I think, the implications of his actions. Now he's fired the director of the FBI. I mean, think about it this way. First, I want to really emphasize Donna's point, which is very important. I mean, the Russians hacked, you know, tried to affect our election. They did, maybe they affected the outcome or not, but they certainly affected the way it was conducted. They've done this elsewhere. It's not like this is a big surprise. That's bad, and that should be a matter of bipartisan concern. And I really do, and it's bad that, frankly, that Donald Trump spent the entire campaign dismissing that as a concern, making fun of it almost as a concern, even, you know, making a big show of inviting the Russians to release Hillary's emails. And then as president-elect, having gotten the briefings that stood behind the intelligence community's unanimous conclusion that the Russians had tried to affect the outcome, and now as president, he remains sort of dismissive of this, basically. That's, I think, a bad sign. I don't know that it doesn't prove that he's guilty of anything. It proves that he just doesn't want to think that Putin would do this, or he doesn't want any credit for the victory going away from him, or whatever. But it's not a good sign. And it's a serious matter, which incidentally has to be dealt with. It's a matter of national security. It's a matter of foreign policy. The other thing, so that we know, the Russians hacked the election, so to speak. Didn't hack the results, but they tried to meddle with the election. The other thing we know, again, is that Trump fired his national security advisor, within the first month, chose to fire the FBI director within the first 100 days. Neither of those has ever happened before. I mean, Clinton had to fire his FBI director, but it was based on ethics charges that were bipartisan. He had support from both parties. He had a successor lined up, incidentally someone from the other party, Louis Freeh, so there would be no problem. It would look like it was a political thing. I mean, so, and he has yet to, of course, to succeed in replacing the FBI director because he hadn't even planned on how to do this. So and he now has a special counsel. So, this is within 120 days. This is never, so when Trump defenders say, well, this is just the media and fake news, there is, some of the news reports have probably been wrong. That's always the case. It was the case in Watergate too, right? We remember the correct reporting. There was a lot of bad reporting at the time that turned out to be false. But it's not about the media. I mean, just these are fact. The fact is his first 120 days has been unprecedented in this respect. Firing his national security advisor, firing his FBI director, having a special counsel. Doesn't prove that he's guilty of anything terrible. Maybe he's just, he made an imprudent nomination or choice as national security advisor to start with, and then he just indulged himself, as it were, in firing the FBI director. They have a special counsel. Maybe nothing will, you know, that will not prove anything about Trump personally or even about Jared Kushner or others. But I would say, as someone who's been in, and we've all been in government in the White House, I mean, the idea of that meeting during the transition that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, meets privately with Russian officials after an election in which it was not unknown at the time that they had meddled in the election, and discusses, apparently, at some level of specificity, sort of, you know, channels that would work around the normal U.S. government and even around the intelligence community, that's pretty startling. Firing the FBI director, I come back to that. The way in which it was done, too, I mean, think about this for a minute. So apparently, Donald Trump in February, then it turns out after he fires him that he had met one-on-one with the FBI director. Leon, you were chief of staff. So the president asked the vice president, the attorney general, and the chief of staff to leave a meeting they were having on something, on terrorism or something, and asked the FBI director, who's investigating the White House at this point, to stay behind and has a one-on-one meeting with him. And depending on who you believe, suggests that maybe he go easy on Flynn or go easy on the investigation. It shows so little understanding of the norms and the protocols of how you behave as president that even if he's innocent, honestly, it sort of alarms, innocent of any underlying crime. It shows so little respect for a certain kind of rule of law and norms of reassuring people that there's an independent investigation and so forth, that it worries me. And then they have the Deputy Attorney General writes this memo about the things Comey may or may not have done wrong. I mean, he probably did mishandle the whole Clinton thing. And then Trump sends Vice President Pence out on TV 7 times the next day to say, yes, he was fired at the recommendation of the Deputy Attorney General because he mishandled the Clinton probe. And then Trump the next morning says, I wanted to fire him anyway all along, and it had nothing to do with the Clinton probe. I mean, you know, in a way, it's just like, oh, we just changed the story. But it does actually affect one's, I think, people's confidence in the rule of law and how government works.
Yeah. Let me, we're going to go to questions from the audience. But before that, I'd like to recognize our question review team, the people that select these questions that are presented to our speakers. And I'd ask you to hold your applause till I introduce the entire group. They are Chelsea Adami, who's a reporter for the Salinas Californian, Fran Gaver, who's our veteran question review team member, Doug McKnight, who is a reporter from KAZU Radio, and Claudia Melendez Salinas, who is an education reporter for the Monterey Herald. If you would thank them for me, please. And Sylvia and I, along with the Panetta Institute of Board of Directors, are very grateful for the generous support that we receive from our sponsors and from our supporters. We are very proud that nearly 700 students have attended this program this past season. The lecture series and the student program would not be possible without the help of our sponsors and our supporters. If you would give them a hand.